The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Welcome to the Bellatrist Podcast. I'm Dave Stevens. Before I get started, I wanted to say thank you to everyone that's listening. I received a report from my podcast hosting company, and I'm amazed at how many people from so many different areas of the world are listening. I have listeners from Holland. I try to pronounce the town, but I'd murder it. It starts with a Z, though. We have Australia, the UK, Belgium, New Zealand, Ireland, Guatemala, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia. It goes on. The list is pretty amazing. Also, a special thank you to the folks that took the time to write a review. Das Gatos Forge, one of my brother bladesmiths. Thanks, man. And also, C.P. Munden. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right there. I loved how you ended your review with, "I, too, am a Bellatrist." That's awesome, man. Choked me up for a second. However, you also said, somewhat fearful that his center-right politics will creep more into the podcast. That certainly got me to think. Am I center-right? I've always thought of myself as pretty left. But I suppose these labels are kind of breaking down now, at least in the U.S. I can't think of any of the checkbox political tests that I don't check to the left side of the ticket, but perhaps the reviewer's point is that we should keep politics out of this podcast. I couldn't agree more. I hate the red-blue bullshit that's ripping the U.S. apart. So I'll redouble my efforts to keep this podcast something that both Rachel Maddow and Newt Gingrich could equally enjoy. So today I read another poem from William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. This is one of the most frequently quoted poems ever written. So many lines, titles, and allusions have been lifted from its few short stanzas that the Paris Review even wrote an article a few years ago in which they commented upon how heavily the poem was being referenced. The Nigerian author Chinua Achebe titled his famous novel Things Fall Apart from this poem, as did Joan Didion in her book Slouching Towards Bethlehem. And countless news articles borrow the lines, "The center cannot hold," or slouching toward something or other. During the presidential election, which resulted in Donald Trump's election to the White House, the phrase, "the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity," was quoted incessantly. In fact, so pervasive is the plundering of this poem for titles and allusions, I was tempted to not even include it in the podcast. I thought, will I be boring people by covering something they've probably already heard 1,000 times? But then I realized I was probably making the philosopher's mistake. That is, projecting one's own perspective and experiences onto the world and assuming that all others share them. Perhaps it would be true that, were I to wish to discuss this poem to an audience of writers or scholars in the humanities, I would be received with a sea of rolled eyes and heavy sighs. But I'm pretty sure that's not my audience. And I was reminded of a line from George Orwell, which he wrote about meeting a young soldier in Spain, and realizing that all of the patriotic slogans, which Orwell had long since interpreted as mere jingoistic state propaganda, were still authentic and fresh to the young man. For the fly-blown words that make me spew still in his ears were holy. In fact, this is what I miss the most about teaching, especially college freshmen and sophomores. Seeing the ideas that, to you, had become old and stale, freshly take seed in young minds, and to watch the enthusiasm of discovery. That moment of, oh wow, then that would mean, emerge as their eyes dart back and forth, mirroring the internal workings of their minds, as the new perspective-altering idea downloads into the brain. It's just cool. It makes you fall in love with the old writings and ideas all over again. So, if you're new to this poem, I'm envious of you, because it is perhaps the most evocative and easily adapted to current situations of all poems. Let's walk through it, because it's not as easily understood as, for example, The Haystack and the Floods. Many readers who are untrained in how to read poetry freeze up when they encounter a highly metaphorical poem such as this. If you're only used to reading prose, you're accustomed to fully understanding each sentence as you read. If you don't understand a sentence, you stop and reread it until you get it, and then move on to the next one. If you try to do this with a poem, however, especially one like this, you'll drive yourself crazy. So remember, you don't have to understand everything about a poem to enjoy it. Sometimes just the language of a poem is so beautiful and suggestive that it's just brain candy. Or another way to think about this is to compare poetry like this to impressionistic paintings. Think of Starry Night by Van Gogh, or Van Gogh, if you adopt a British version, or Van Flemsound, if you want to use the Dutch, the apparently correct pronunciation. Anyway. Imagine getting up close to the piece and looking at a single square inch of the painting. You'd have no idea what was going on in that inch. If you'd done the same thing to a Pre-Raphaelite painting, you'd know precisely what it was. Oh, that's a few blades of grass. Or, oh, that's the hem of a dress. So when you look at Starry Night, you don't look at any specific bit. You sort of stand back and squint at it. And wham! You suddenly see a blaze of stars in stately motion above a moonlight village. And what's more, because the painting is not specific to a precise time and place, it can come to you whenever one encounters a vista that evokes its memory. Once I was sailing in the Caribbean, near an island called Fallen Jerusalem, because the rock formations on it look like a ruined city, and Van Gogh's painting surged into my brain in a moment of recognition. It was like seeing a teenage niece for the first time in many years and having that moment of poignant confusion in which some part of your brain sees your sister from years past. So the point here is to relax. Just sit back and squint your eyes at the poem. If you don't get it, don't worry. You're not really supposed to. But poems like this are the duct tape of figurative language. They're extremely useful in elucidating certain types of human experiences. And like duct tape, the most evocative poems tend to be slapped on almost anything. So let's walk through the poem. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. First lines punch you right in the nose with the theme. God, what a great, efficient use of language this is. 13 words, and already we have a clear impression that things are spiraling out of control in whatever world the poem describes. Oh, a gyre, by the way, is just a circular current, like a whirlpool or hurricane. In my mind's eye, this line always produces the image of a man standing in a field, wearing the glove of a falconer, struggling to stand against the howling winds, looking up in desperation at a swirling sky filled with storm clouds. The hawk is tumbling and lost. The man screams and screams, but the hawk can't hear him, and he's swept away in the dark winds. Now, perhaps you might be saying at this point, yeah, Dave, that's cool, but you just made that shit up. The poem doesn't have any of that. But that's the point. It's designed to get your imagination started and let you fill in the blanks. That's the way these things work. You know the movie Alien? Remember how terrifying it was? Did you ever stop and think, how often did we actually see the alien? Almost never. And when you did, you just saw a small bit of it. The fangs dripping, the flash of its tail. Most of it was cloaked in shadows. The reason that movie was so terrifying was that your mind is better at filling in the blank bits with something scary than even the most advanced CGI. The same is true with almost anything. Give your mind something to start with, something that touches us in our deepest primal instinctive bits, and your imagination will do the rest. Moving on. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Again, the reader is not supposed to have any clear picture of what's happening in these lines. In fact, not having a clear picture is kind of the point. The theme of the poem is the confusion, terror, and chaos that happens when things fall apart. Something that has happened quite often in human history. This poem could apply to the fall of the Roman Empire, both the world wars, or whichever moment in human history where the thin veneer of civilization is suddenly and shockingly stripped away. You know, I have some friends that are former Special Forces guys. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with them on the theme of how naive most Westerners are vis-a-vis the stability of our civilization. Most people walk through life believing that no matter how bad things get politically, the electricity and cell phone signal will always stay on. Groceries and gasoline will always be stocked. If you call 911, someone with a gun will show up to protect you. These guys know better. They've seen countries go from complacent peace to bloody chaos in a matter of days. We take so much for granted. The paradise in which we live is fragile and precious. This poem is a glimpse of what it feels like when you start to realize that the thin veneer of civilization is slipping away. Incidentally, the word mere sometimes trips readers up in this line. Mere anarchy, to our modern ear, sounds like he's saying, don't worry, it's merely anarchy, no big deal. In fact, the way in which words are used changes with the times. Think of the way young people use the word literally to mean figuratively today. Which, by the way, figuratively makes my head explode. Anyway, the word mere in this context means pure or absolute. So, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world means pure anarchy is loosed upon the world. And what does he mean by the ceremony of innocence? Like all great poems of this sort, each phrase can be unpacked into a full essay. And with a poem this famous, I can assure you, it already has been. This, like most of the poem, is a phrase that is apt to be applied to many situations. Some analysts suggest that Yeats must be referring to La Belle Époque, the beautiful time, which was the period just before the start of the Great War. However, I think that a more general interpretation of this phrase is appropriate. Ceremony implies tradition. Innocence is a kind of naive purity. To kill or drown the ceremony of innocence is to strip away the cultural bedrock on which a society rests. A good example of this is the scene from the movie Braveheart, in which the English lord comes to the Scottish wedding to claim the right of prima noctra, or first night, in which he will rape the bride. The scene captures skillfully the way in which one of the key traditions on which Scottish culture had existed, the marriage ceremony, could so easily and quickly be defiled. The lines, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity," are perhaps one of the most often cited from this piece. And why not? Here we find a cutting, if somewhat depressing, insight into the human condition that modern science has now identified as the Dunning-Kruger effect. This effect, according to the two researchers who are the namesakes of this theory, observes that up until one achieves virtuoso-level talent in a given field, one's confidence on a subject is inversely proportional to one's expertise in that area. So in other words, ask Heather Hein, the evolutionary biologist, a question on biology, and you will get a virtuoso-level answer delivered with high confidence. Ask someone without even a high school education the same question, and you will get a, very likely wrong, but nevertheless similarly high confidence response. Ask a graduate student with several years of advanced study on this subject the same question, and you'll probably get a highly hedged answer, likely to be filled with phrases such as, well, there's probably someone in the room that knows more about this than me, but, or I believe it might be X, but you might consult Y expert. And who could have failed to notice that at times of crisis, it always is the stupidest that seem to be the loudest? Anyway, we could talk about that for a long time. Let's move on to the second stanza, which can be pretty confusing. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. A waste of desert sand, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it wind shadows of the indignant desert birds. The second coming, of course, refers to the Christian apocalyptic belief, primarily laid down in the book of Revelations, that Jesus will return to earth and his coming will herald the apocalyptic end of times. And Spiritus Mundi literally means world spirit in Latin, and it refers to the essential nature or spirit of the age. For example, one might say the Spiritus Mundi of our time is a kind of frantic narcissism, of desperate self-promotion, characterized by the endless selfies of young people and the fact that every moron thinks he's clever enough to warrant his own podcast. Anyway, moving on. Instead of Jesus returning on clouds, however, we're given a picture of the stone sphinx of Egypt suddenly coming to life as a pitiless monster. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. This stanza is not very hard to understand. According to Christianity, 20 centuries roughly have passed since the birth of Jesus in the manger in Bethlehem. All the while, the monster depicted in the poem is sleeping, but has been vexed to nightmare. What does that mean? Well, again, this poem is hard to pin down, but it seems to suggest that the innocent baby Jesus' birth caused the sleeping beast to begin tossing in its ancient slumber with nightmares. And now, after being tortured for 2,000 years, it's awake, and it's pissed. So, the contrast between the babe in the manger being born and the rough beast slouching toward Bethlehem is a vision that's disturbed for decades. There is a sense in it of inevitable consequences. The stanza seems to suggest that our innocence and arrogance has inevitably led to whatever dreadful, unexpected doom has suddenly arrived on our doorstep, like an unwanted court summons. I once read a fairly second-rate novel in an Irish literature course. I won't tell you which because I don't want to recommend it, and I don't want to unnecessarily denigrate an author, but there was one line that stayed with me from this book. At the end of the novel, the main character was surrounded by enemies. One of the final lines of the book was something like, he was grateful that someone was finally going to beat the hell out of him, as if his guilty conscience was relieved to be held to task at last. Doesn't this line seem appropriate, given our current Spiritus Mundi? In the West especially, we seem grateful that someone is finally beating the hell out of us. And if we turn around, we can realize that we are the ones doing the beating. At any rate, I hope you enjoyed this highly referenced poem. It's definitely one that any educated person should have in their brain. And as always, remember, the purpose of literature is not to save your soul. It is to make your soul worth saving. See you next podcast. Now here's the poem, one more time. The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.